good afternoon, or good evening, and welcome to Inside the Writer Studio, the podcast where we talk with writers about their lives, their craft, their business, and their latest work. I'm your host, Charlie Lovett, and our podcast is sponsored by Bookmarks. Bookmarks is a literary nonprofit whose programs include the largest annual book festival in the Carolinas. Come visit Bookmarks at our community gathering space and nonprofit independent bookstore in downtown Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Inside the Writer Studio is also proud to be an affiliate of Libro FM, the audiobook platform that supports your local independent bookstore. Stay tuned at the end of the podcast for more information on Libro FM and a special offer. My guest today is fellow North Carolina novelist Wiley Cash, who will be joining us here in Winston-Salem at the Bookmarks Festival on September 24th and 25th. His new novel is When Ghosts Come Home. Wiley, welcome to Inside the Writer Studio.
Thank you so much for having me, Charlie. I appreciate it.
So I get to introduce you on Saturday and say a little something about what this book is about. So today I'll let you tell us a little something about the book before we dive into the questions.
Well, the book opens in the fall of 1984, and it is a few days before a sheriff who's in his mid-60s is facing a really tough re-election battle. And on this particular evening, he is awakened in the middle of the night by the roar of a low-flying aircraft, and he knows it is much too late for a plane to be flying that low over his house on its way to a little municipal airfield. So he goes out to investigate what he believes he's heard. And when he arrives at this turf airfield, it's a grass track, he finds an abandoned DC-3, which is a World War II era cargo plane. It's much too large for this tiny runway. It's crash landed, the landing gear has been broken, and the plane is completely abandoned. There is no one there. There is nothing inside of it. Later, they don't even find any fingerprints. But lying alongside the runway is the body of a local man who's been shot dead and left behind. And this man is the son of a local civil rights leader who's also a high school history teacher. And he is a Black man. So immediately rumors and suspicions spring up about, you know, illegal drugs being flown in, the Black community's role in this, and all of these racial elements and buried secrets and ghosts of the past come to a head just a few days before this election is about to be held, and this sheriff finds himself confronted with these tensions and these pressures and these issues that he never could have imagined.
Yeah. It was interesting to me. I would go back and forth about what kind of novel am I reading, because every time I was convinced, no, this is definitely one of those novels that's about culture and about race, but then the mystery would come back. I'm like, oh yeah, it is a mystery book too.
Yeah.
So let's start at the beginning. One of the first people we're introduced to is Winston, the sheriff, and then his wife, Marie. And the first thing we find out about Marie is that she's ill. She's possibly gravely ill. And that's sort of, we find that out before we even really have a chance to make an emotional connection with her as a character. Why did you want to start out on that point for us to know that right at the beginning as we go in?
Well, I was saying more about Winston than I was really saying about Marie, you know. And I like what you said about, you know, kind of forgetting you were reading a mystery, and and that's probably my fault, because I don't really know how to write a straight ahead mystery. If I did, I'd probably sell more books. But I don't. That's not really my strength as a writer. My strength, I believe, is in rendering what I hope are deep characterizations that resonate with the reader. And when I discovered Winston's character, I thought, okay, this is a guy who's battling for re-election. He has this mystery dropped into his lap, but what are the pressures his character is under? Mm-hmm. And his ailing wife is one of them. You know, this is a family that if he loses this re-election, they lose their health insurance. And then what do? They're not in a financial position to come out of pocket to pay for his wife's treatment. And so I wanted the novel to begin with Winston having these various complications. And then very soon we learn about the tragedies that his daughter has faced. And we learn all of these things before he even discovers the aircraft. And so I wanted him to have a certain heaviness about him where he has all of these external pressures building up around him. But these family complications are these really come to bear on him in internal ways that really weigh him down.
Yeah, I found it really interesting. I'd never really thought about the fact in this age of sort of celebrity politicians that at many levels, when you lose an election, you're out of a job. I mean, mm-hmm. and so that particular tension was one that had not really occurred to me as much. I think there's really there's a definite emotional tone to the opening of this book, these first few pages, that goes beyond just sympathy for Marie or worrying about what's going, these things, various pressures that are going on with Winston. How did you want your readers to feel as they're reading the first several pages of the book? And what do you do to make them feel the way you want them to feel?
Well, the novel is set right off the coast of North Carolina, right off the coast of just south of Wilmington and Brunswick County on Oak Island, North Carolina. And it's set in the mid-1980s. And in the off season, you know, Labor Day on, Oak Island, especially in the 80s, was a very quiet, very lonely, very kind of dusky, dark place, especially in the middle of the night, you know, 3 a.m. as Winston is driving out. And it's a long, thin island that has beautiful oak trees and yaupon trees, but it's a very mysterious place, and it feels very claustrophobic. It feels very much like a dark tunnel when you make the drive down Oak Island Drive, as I've done. My parents moved down there in 1998. I've made that drive many, many times, two times, too many times to count. And I wanted the opening of the book to feel that way to the reader. I wanted them to feel as if they were entering an experience through a tunnel to a specific place. I was taking them down into this landscape. I was taking them into a dark atmosphere. I was taking them to a place where moss hangs from trees and brackish water laps in the waterway, and the silhouettes of pine trees wait on the edge of the runway. I wanted them to feel immersed in this landscape the same way that Winston does. And we never come out of it until the very, very end of the book.
And that brings up my next question, which is about setting. So I grew up in the Piedmont of North Carolina, and here we're divided into mountain people and beach people, right? And I was always mountain people. So to me, the beach of North Carolina is as foreign as, you know, the beaches of Sicily or Greece, you know, even though it's only a 3.5-hour drive from where I live. So how do you create a setting that has that specificity that you were talking about, but that still will resonate with readers for whom it is a pretty alien environment?
You know, that's a great question, Charlie. And writing this book, all of my books have been set, you know, I only have three before this one, this is my fourth, but they've all been set in the western part of the state. And my wife's from here, and we moved down here in 2013 to Wilmington, where we live, and both of my daughters, who are 6 and 5, were born here. And I thought, you know, if I'm going to understand something about this place that even is similarly resonant of the ways in which my daughters, who are of this place, are going to understand it, I'm going to have to write about it. I'm really going to have to throw myself into it. And so this book is an attempt for me to try to know this place. And so, you know, when readers who are from, you know, whether it's Winston-Salem or Phoenix, Arizona, or Spokane, Washington, read it, they're going to be seeing Oak Island through the eyes of somebody who's not from here, both the author and the main character, Winston Barnes, who is not from Oak Island either. And so I hope that however evocative this place is on the page will speak to an outsider's perception of it.
Yeah. I will say that when I was reading this book, we took one of the first trips outside of our home that we have taken in a very long time, and went with our daughter and son-in-law down to Wilmington for a few days. And we're sitting out on the beach, and my daughter's like, "Well, what book are you reading?" I'm like, "Well, it's set right over there."
Just down the shoreline.
But the other thing that's specific about the setting of this novel is the time period. It's actually set over a period of just a few days in 1984, which is a year that I remember very well. What made you choose that particular time? I think you said you first went to the island in 1998. What could you do narratively in 1984 that you wouldn't have been able to do if you had set the novel now or in some other time period?
Well, I think that 1984 was a watershed moment in American culture and politics and history. At that time, you know, we did not on a national level, certainly not in the media, which, you know, drives oftentimes the national narrative. And then it's the job of the historian or the writer to peel back that national narrative and see what underpins it that may have been overlooked. But if you look at the news coverage in 1984, we were a very unified country. Ronald Reagan won 49 states, except for Walter Mondale's home state of Minnesota. He won 60% of the popular vote. It was a moment where it was morning in America. We were going to be the city on the hill once again. But at the same time, Bruce Springsteen singing, "I'm born down in a dead man's town. The first hit I took was when I hit the ground." You know, we have the rise of all, you know, the drug program DARE. We have this creeping fear of outsiders. We have the myth of the welfare queen coming to the fore. And just a couple of years later, we would have the Willie Horton character coming into the fore. So we have the AIDS crisis, the AIDS epidemic going on that's not being addressed. So we were a country that was really torn apart, but glazed over by, you know, Ronald Reagan's smiling grandfatherly face and the promise of the cowboy who was going to deliver us to the city on the hill, as I mentioned. And so, you know, being raised in conservative, Christian, Baptist, white North Carolina, I never questioned that implied identity. You know, I was raised in the shadow of Reagan and Jesse Helms, and I'm sure you remember that as well as I do. But those implied beliefs were never questioned. And so I was really interested in going back to a time when implied beliefs and social stances and political and cultural ideas weren't questioned in my community. And then mirroring them in our contemporary time, where our social, cultural, political ideas are very explicit. You know, you say what you believe when you wear a mask, or when you wear a wet red hat that says "Make America Great Again," or when you put a Black Lives Matter or defund the police or a "Thank You Jesus" sign in your yard. You're making very explicit statements that we could have never imagined being that explicit in 1984. But these conversations are still urgent and necessary. And I just thought it would be interesting to parallel our two times.
Yeah. I think it's fair to call this a North Carolina novel. And that begs the question, what is a North Carolina novel? Or what even is a Southern novel? There are plenty of us who live and write in North Carolina and the South, who write novels, who probably wouldn't be classified as North Carolina novelists or Southern novelists. So what do you see as the essence of a North Carolina novel?
You know, I think a North Carolina novel is a novel that really explores all the conflicts inherent both to the foundations of North Carolina as a state, but also the cultural tensions and the historical tensions, and also kind of the geographic tensions that we have in this state. You know, I think North Carolina is a wonderful place to be a writer, because when you're a writer, you're looking for tension, because tension is what makes characters uncomfortable. It's where stories come from. It's what makes people make bad decisions or good decisions. And there's nothing more delicious for a writer than to explore those bad decisions. And, you know, North Carolina is a state that every 4 years we're at odds with our previous 4 years. And even down on like a smaller, seemingly less significant level about college basketball or what kind of barbecue is best or cheer wine versus sun drop, or, you know, these seemingly fleeting, unimportant distinctions are still tension filled. And so I think that North Carolina, a North Carolina novel is a novel that takes on those, you know, maybe uses local color to portray some of those smaller tensions, as I mentioned, in food or sports or, you know, popular parlance, but really grapples with those larger tensions of the geopolitical tensions, the historical tensions, the cultural tensions. And in that way, provides a microcosm for the entire experience, or a macrocosm of the entire experience in the United States, of we're a nation that's oftentimes very much at conflict with itself. And North Carolina, which has historically been a very politically moderate state, is a state that is in constant conflict with itself.
Yeah, it's, you know, I'm thinking about what you said about how in 1984 we were much less explicit about, you know, announcing what tribe we were a part of. Mm-hmm. And I will have to say, as a North Carolinian born and bred, you have to put an exception in that statement for college basketball, because sure. I can still tell you people I was in elementary school with, whether they were Carolina fans or Wake Forest fans, you know,
and you felt like it in
50 years.
Yeah. And you felt like it says something about them. Like sometimes that breaks down along class levels. It's fascinating how that works.
Absolutely. So we learn a lot about Winston's backstory pretty early on in the novel. How important to you is what happens to characters before the novel begins, and how much more of that do you know than the reader knows?
I probably intuit more than the reader's shown, especially in this novel. But I think backstory is really important, especially for a character like Winston. And for me, backstory is important in terms of the character because it contextualizes who they are and what they might do. So, for example, Winston has to make a lot of decisions in this novel, and he's never very sure-footed in the decisions that he makes. And that's because he's made some missteps in his past. Yep. And so, you know, he's not as confident as he wants to be about the things that are facing him. So I always think about that as being, you know, particularly beneficial to characterization. But I really like backstory in terms of the narrative, because whenever we feel, you know, I tell my students when I teach fiction writing that as writers, we have a writer sense. We intuit things about the narrative that our writer sense picks up, and we make stylistic or plot or character flourishes based on what our writer sense is nagging us about. And I feel like whenever a narrative slows down, like let's say that a character is waiting for someone to arrive, like there's a scene where Winston's daughter is waiting for him to pick her up at the airport, or there's a scene where Winston is driving from his house out to the airport in the middle of the night, I need to use that time to do something. And I can't progress the narrative with that time, because there's no real action. The characters are static.
Yeah.
So I have to progress the character. I have to deepen the characterization. And so backstory is an opportunity there to do just that. And I think it speaks to the motivations of the character, but it also fills in those static moments in the narrative.
Yeah. I never thought about that, of using backstory as a way to control pacing. That's a really great idea. Winston says something early on that really struck me. He says he believes in what he calls walking a fine line of legal authority and cultural memory.
Sure.
What does he mean by that? And in what ways does that idea have relevance in 2021?
Well, I think it especially has relevance in 2021. Yeah. You know, I think the obvious thing is just saying something like cultural race theory, which mm-hmm. really doesn't exist. It's just called, in reality, critical race theory is just called history.
Yeah. Yeah.
And nobody even said that term until, you know, the day after Joe Biden's inauguration, when suddenly that's the new thing that we're supposed to be afraid of. And so I think that when you're an elected official, you want to walk that fine line between the legal authority. Say you're a school board member and somebody says, well, do you believe in critical race theory? You have to walk that fine line of saying, you know, we don't teach critical race theory, while also knowing the importance of teaching things like, you know, historical inequities in terms of like redlining voting rights and political representation and things like that. So you're not going to call it critical race theory, but you're going to teach history. And I think that, you know, that exact thing, same thing happened here in Wilmington. You know, our local police chief, Donnie Williams, the first Black police chief in Wilmington's history, you know, right after he was named police chief, these couple of white officers are caught on their dash cams talking about murdering Black protesters and mowing them down and the joy and the glee that would give them. And so Donnie Williams, like right on the job, brand new, has to walk this fine line between not stepping afoul of whatever white supremacist sentiments are inherent in Wilmington's legacy and cultural memory, while also towing the legal line of like, what do I do with officers who are going to espouse this kind of vitriol and just unacceptable rhetoric on the job?
Yeah. So one of the, you know, you talked about the plane landing, but one of the other precipitating events at the beginning of this novel is the imminent arrival of Colleen, the daughter of Winston and Marie, who has recently lost a baby. And we first meet her in the middle of the night. And I think the way you introduce us to her is a good opportunity to talk about how you use details in creating character. You know, she is drinking a beer at 3:12 in the morning, not at 3 o'clock, not 3:15. So can you talk a little bit about that use of details to create character?
Sure. Yeah. You know, when I think of characterization, I don't ever want to have a narrator. And in this novel, I have kind of an omniscient or a limited third person narrator who's limited to whatever character the narrator's portraying. And Colleen's section begins very similar to Winston's. It follows his opening section. You know, she wakes up in the middle of the night as well.
Yeah.
She's 2 hours behind her father. So he's already discovered the plane by the time she wakes up. But it's, you know, it's the middle of the night where she is, and she's fleeing her home. She's, you know, lost a child. She's nursing this tragic outcome with her husband. They've kind of grown apart very quickly. They got married kind of in a rush because she was pregnant, and now she's in Dallas, Texas. She feels far from home. She feels far from him, and she decides to fly home, and she flees their home in the middle of the night after having a couple of beers. And you know, that's a consistent thing that she does throughout the novel, is she kind of drinks to find kind of the courage or maybe the mysticism in some way to make tough decisions. But details are really important there. You know, I kind of walk you through her house as she leaves. Yeah. And I don't want to have the narrator tell you. Colleen is someone who's heartbroken. So I give you the details. So the door to her child's nursery that they never got to use is closed. And I give you the detail of Colleen stuffing a folded towel under that door as if she can trap inside whatever remaining of her son might be in there, right? Yep. Yep. I want to give you that because it's a thing, it's tactile, it's a physical thing, and it communicates more than saying Colleen is sad, right? And then when Colleen is standing in the kitchen and she can't decide whether to like leave a note to her husband or not, instead of saying Colleen is indecisive, I want to show the physical manifestation of her indecisiveness.
Yeah.
And so it's, you know, there's the old maxim, show, don't tell. And I don't think that's always the best advice, but I think in a scene, a tactile scene, which is to say, a portion of your story where you move characters through space and have descriptions, I think using things to portray, to contextualize character and emotion is the way to go, at least in the kind of novels that I'm writing.
Yeah. And I think Colleen, that whole scene and that introduction to her is a good example of, I just jotted this down and I honestly don't remember if this phrase was something that you wrote in your book or if I wrote it down because you made me think of it, but I wrote down tragedy magnifies the details of life. Mm-hmm. How do you think that idea plays out in this novel?
You know, I think tragedy does magnify the details of life, especially in the immediate news of the tragedy. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, we had the world becomes very, it's as if we're looking at the world through a periscope and we see everything in these very fine details. And we have, you know, our ears ring with silence in those moments of tragedy because we're trying to hear everything at the same time. Our pupils expand to let in more light. It's a fight or flight reaction so that we can see more things, escape routes, weapons, things that we can use to fight or to grasp for understanding. Mm-hmm. And so I think that the tragedy and panic and uncertainty, you know, we remember it in such detail when it is outside of us, when it's something we're witnessing, especially. I think trauma works a little bit differently, but I think in those moments of decisive, you know, those decisive moments following tragedy, the world becomes hyper focused for us because we're investigating, we're trying to make sense of what we've just learned. Tragic news, a tragic accident, you know. And it's a heightened sensory moment for a character.
So, not surprisingly, being set in rural North Carolina in 1984, race plays a really big role in this novel. We've kind of mentioned a few things about it, but can you talk about the ways in which race figures in the narrative? And again, like, you know, was Black Lives Matter happening when you were writing this novel? Was the racial situation in 2021 sort of first and foremost in your mind as you're working on it? How do those sort of connect to each other?
I don't know if it was necessarily Black Lives Matter was front and center in my mind, but I can definitely say that this is a novel that takes on a lot of racial themes and elements and historical elements. I mean, you know, once drug smuggling in the mid-1980s is tied to a Black citizenship or Black citizens, that allows so many other things to be furthered: surveillance, suspicion, profiling. And that's definitely what happens here. And the sheriff's challenger in this election is the you know, the young, you know, he's not even middle-aged son of a real estate developer, this really wealthy white guy who's playing with daddy's money, who's never, you know, risked anything in his life. And he plays kind of white nationalist in the novel. And when he is able to tie this mysterious airplane to the Black community, he sees an opportunity to gain power in the local election. And so he starts stirring up all these long-buried racial sentiments and starts drumming up all this racial anxiety and saying, look, I'm going to keep you safe. This sheriff is sympathetic to this Black community. He's not doing a thing about these people. And I'm the one who's going to keep you safe. And I'm going to stop drugs from coming into this community. And we see that happen so much. And you know, law and order presidents, we know what all of that stuff means. Yeah. You're following the civil rights movement of Richard Nixon, you know, the 68 election, or I can't even remember what election it was. I believe it was 68. He's going to be the law and order president. You know, Trump's going to make America great again. And even when he was asked, like, when was America last time it was great? He said the 1950s, which is, of course, pre-civil rights legislation, pre-voting rights. And so it's no surprise that when people want to deal with these nationalist sympathies, there are oftentimes white supremacist sympathies, that we're going to return to a 1950s mindset of segregation, following the rules, law and order, these very rigid Jim Crow pre-civil rights ideas of what America should be.
So one of the challenges I think a lot of us are facing these days in writing is, you know, you're a white man, you're writing some Black characters, you have a Black teenage character, you have an older civil rights activist, and you have several characters in between. How do we find that sweet spot between having cultural diversity in our writing without cultural appropriation?
You know, that's a great question. And I think that's the challenge of a writer, and has been throughout time. Just oftentimes writers weren't held to the expectation of rising to meet that challenge. And so, of course, we have a lot of, you know, caricatures throughout Southern literature and throughout all literature, to be honest. It's not just the South that's guilty of creating caricatures across relying on racial stereotypes, and not just in Black characters. But, you know, something that I feel very strongly about is that in order to tell the complete story, I have to tell the complete story. And I've got to, if I have to speak from the perspective of a Black character or a female character, in order to tell the story that not only I feel is an accurate portrayal, but I genuinely believe is an accurate portrayal, I've got to, you know, take on some identities or experiences that aren't inherent to my own identity or my own experience. And, you know, and I try to do that as accurately and as honestly as I can. And I rely on, you know, many things, the experiences of friends, the experiences of text, the knowledge of history, of culture, of my own study, and you know, my graduate school experience and education, and all the things that I've had to confront and deal with and sort through. And if I get it right, then that just means the story is accurately represented. And if I get it wrong, then I'm going to have to confront the blowback that anyone might have about those characterizations and investigate them honestly and openly and see what I can do better next time.
I mean, if you're writing from the point of view of a woman who's lost a baby, a Black teenager whose friend has been landed in trouble, is it a Black civil rights activist? Do you share your manuscript with people who maybe are closer to that mold than you are, to see if it resonates with them?
Not necessarily consciously or on purpose. I don't really have any like cultural guardrails that I'm trying to guide me down the log flume of the novel as I careening out of control. You know, I just kind of do the work and try to do it as honestly as I can. And then along the way, confront many of my own discomforts, many of my own uncertainties, many of my own inconsistencies with how I was raised and how I choose to live now and how I choose to raise my children, our children now. And, you know, that's a process of becoming an adult, not just the process of being a writer.
Yeah. Yeah. Winston often finds himself existing kind of on the edges of other people's grief. And that strikes me as inherent in law enforcement. Can you talk about portraying the tragedies that are witnessed by law enforcement playing out in their own emotional lives, and particularly for Winston?
Yeah, you know, Winston is somebody who does absorb the grief of others. He's absorbed his wife's struggles with her health. He's absorbed his daughter's tragic emotions surrounding the loss of his grandson. He's absorbed his friend Ed Bellamy's loss of his grown son, Rodney Bellamy's widow's loss of her husband, their newborn child's loss of a father he'll never know. And so, you know, I think law enforcement, the medical community, I mean, we're seeing it right now with COVID. You know, our medical community is asked to shoulder just an unbearable burden in dealing with the grief that these families are going through with these. You know, we're closing in on 700,000 COVID deaths over the past year and a half, and that grief does not evaporate with life. It has to be burdened. It has to be shared by someone. And so, you know, when these law enforcement officers, whether they be sheriffs or police chiefs or deputies or officers, knock on doors in the middle of the night and share bad news, I can't imagine that they get in their cruiser or patrol car and shake it off and turn the radio on after that and never think about it again. I mean, these are amalgamations of griefs and challenges with what I imagine are very few triumphs over the course of a career. And these people carry incredible burdens.
Yeah.
And many of them, like Winston, probably also carry incredible guilt.
One of the things that really struck true for me, I mean, I've never been a sheriff, but I've had to deliver bad news to people, is his Winston's hesitance, his almost fear of having to go and knock on a door and say, you know, your son is lying dead in a field. You know, and I think we often think of law enforcement as tough, which a lot of them are, but I really liked seeing that sort of emotional rawness of him, because I felt like that's how I would feel. I would be afraid to go and knock on the guy's door, even though I knew.
Yeah. And he also knows Ed Bellamy, and, you know, they've fought side by side for some things, and they've butted head over other things, but there's a mutual respect. They know one another's families. And in these small towns, like, when you know somebody's family, it's really difficult to deliver either bad news or tragic news. And I wanted Winston to feel as human as possible in those moments.
Mm-hmm. So there's one character, I wasn't going to name him, but you kind of already had alluded to him earlier in this novel, who I took an almost immediate dislike to. And this is the guy who's running against Winston for sheriff. What's it like to create an unsympathetic character? I mean, you talk about working very hard to create realistic characters across racial and gender divides and everything, but here's a guy who, you know, you want us to dislike, and yet we still have to believe that he's real and not mm-hmm. a character. How is that different, to create the unsympathetic character as opposed to the sympathetic character?
It is difficult. And at first, Bradley Fry wasn't much of a character. He was kind of in the background as Winston's challenger, and I didn't think that he was even going to be worthy of the page that much. He was just going to be the nagging, you know, person biting at Winston's heels. And then I saw that Bradley Fry was really kind of the apotheosis of Southern upper class white entitlement. You know, this is a guy who's never risked anything. He was born into money. He was born into a life of ease. And he confuses that with intelligence. He confuses that with ability. And it's amazing how often and how easily people like Bradley Fry can attain power, because of their access to unlimited funds, which they believe holds them out as almost like a, you know, John Winthrop Calvinist preordained election from God or the Almighty to be the leaders of community. And it goes back to kind of this Calvinist idea in America. We believe that, well, if somebody's rich, then they're smart. If somebody's rich, then they're good. If somebody's rich, then they've worked hard. So they deserve major tax breaks because look how hard they've worked. They deserve a larger voice in the community because look at how successful they've been.
Yeah.
You know, they deserve to have these opinions because they've earned them. But in reality, they were just born. And everybody's born, and not everybody gets to have the same power and opinion and offerings that the wealthy do.
I found that really interesting when you said he started out as somebody that you weren't going to pay much attention to. I just got done reading Amor Tyll's new book, The Lincoln Highway, and I felt like it was one of those novels where he would not let us dismiss someone as a minor character. Every time you thought somebody was a minor character, he would go, wait a minute, let me tell you some more about this person. And I felt that in this novel too, that, you know, even the smaller characters were fully developed people. Talk about a minute about the challenge of having a character who's got a lot less stage time being as fully realized as a human, as somebody where you've got, you know, pages and chapters to talk about them.
You know, I think it's fun. I think that the secondary characters, the tertiary characters are really an opportunity for an author to cut loose and have fun with characters who may not come to bear on the construction and the scaffolding of the plot in the way the main characters
will. Yeah.
And so you can bring a life and a color and a humanity to them without a lot of undergirding them in the plot as it unfolds. Mm-hmm. And so my minor characters in this novel, and I hope in all my novels, are slice of life people that we all know, we've all come up against. And I find that freeing. I find that, and most importantly, you know, as you know, writing novels yourself and having to spend a lot of time, it's fun. It's fun to spend time.
Yeah. I felt like I got to the end of chapter 3 and I felt like if I had been reading a screenplay, I would have said, okay, that was act 1. Mm-hmm. Colleen's arrived. We've met all the major characters. We've had all their problems laid out for us. How do you view the structure of the novel? You see individual chapters, but do you see, you know, sort of larger arcs within the novel beyond just this chapter, next chapter?
You know, not really. When I'm writing this, you know, I didn't know what was going to happen in this novel. And I didn't know what was going to happen at the end. And I mean, I finished like, quote unquote, writing it. And I just sent it all to my editor. And he was like, hey, man, these characters are fascinating. They're so interesting. I was so involved and I care for them. What's going to happen? And I said, man, I don't know. I have no idea. And that always happens. Except for my first book, that kind of always happens because I get so carried away living in the lives of these characters that I forget to kind of build them into a plot, you know?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I knew the airplane was going to happen. That's what brings all these people together. But I knew what I wanted the emotional weather of the novel to be at the end.
Yeah.
I didn't always know how I was going to get there.
Yeah.
And I tried several endings, you know, my wife read, my agent read, my editor read, and it was just kind of like, man, this isn't it. And then the ending that I finally arrived at, it might not have been the ending that my heart wanted, mm-hmm. But it was the most practical, satisfying, likely ending. And it just so happened that it's got a couple of big reveals, some twists and turns. And when I finished it, I thought, my God, I've actually written a real mystery. And that was thrilling.
I obviously won't say anything about what happens at the end of the novel, but I will tell readers that you will be shouting out loud at characters about things you want them to do or not to do. I just, mm-hmm. which to me is sort of the essence of a mystery where tension builds towards the end. And, you know, you want a character to go a certain way or you want them to not go a certain way. Yeah. The ghost, as we see in the title, the ghosts of this town sort of hang over the novel in interesting ways, and they obviously creep into the title. Tell us a little bit about the title And what you see as the ghosts in this story?
Well, you know, for a long time, my daughters would say, well, who's flying the airplane? They called this novel The Mysterious Airplane. They were 3 and 4 when I began working on it, around about in there. And I said, I don't know who's flying it. And they said, well, maybe a ghost is flying it.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of always a placeholder, like, yeah, a ghost is flying the airplane. And then the more I thought about ghosts, the more I thought, God, there are so many ghosts in this novel. There's, yeah. You know, even Ed Bellamy, the civil rights leader and history teacher who loses his son, is haunted by the ghost of Vietnam. He's haunted by the ghost of the civil rights era. He's haunted by the flagrant and even the casual racism that he suffered in his youth in this rural area that he still lives in. And of course, the sheriff is haunted by the ghost of the decisions he made. People are haunted by the ghost of the dead. They're haunted by even by indecision. And all of these ghosts, whether they be, you know, intellectual ghosts, emotional ghosts, physical ghosts, they all at one point or another come home in this novel. And they deliver themselves unto these characters in ways that just continually surprised me and continually resonated with me while I was writing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we like to end every episode of Inside the Writer's Studio with the same 10 questions. You should be able to answer each of them in just a few words, but hopefully they'll give us a little insight into you and into your writing. So if you're ready, we will begin.
Let's do it.
What word do you love to work into your writing?
Wow. I don't know that I love a single word. I use said a lot because I don't like other dialogue tags.
Yeah. Yeah. What word do you hate to encounter in other people's writing?
Any kind of gerund used in dialogue.
Mm-hmm. Where's your favorite place to write?
At the desk that I'm sitting at right now.
Where could you never write?
In a coffee shop.
To what rule of grammar do you pay least attention?
Incomplete sentences.
What was the first book you remember reading?
The Enormous Egg, I think it was called. It was a young adult book, middle grade reader, about a chicken that gives birth to a dinosaur egg.
What are you reading now?
I am reading again my friend Jason Mott's book, Hell of a Book. We'll be in Winston-Salem together next Friday night. I'm teaching it in my class at UNC Asheville.
Oh, great. Great.
Stunning. It's brilliant. It's a brilliant book.
What book would you like to have written?
What book would I like to have written? Oh my gosh, so many of them. Song of Solomon is one book, Toni Morrison's novel. I obviously could never have written that and spoken for that community in that time period as well and as holy and as responsibly as she did. But that is a book that just continually mystifies me, the ways in which it comes together. And so I'm endlessly jealous of that book. And there are others that I'll think about later that are contemporary books, but I've always been so envious of that book's power.
What sort of book would you like to write, but probably never will?
I would like to write a book for my girls that is in some ways about me, but is also about ways in which I've come to know myself and my place in this world through the books I have read.
Mm-hmm. And finally, what would you like to hear a reader tell you?
I found something of my own experience in your book.
This has been Inside the Writer's Studio. I'm your host, Charlie Lovett, and my guest today has been Wiley Cash, whose novel When Ghosts Come Home is available wherever books are sold. You can hear me and Wiley talk some more along with our friend Ann Bogle, the modern Mrs. Darcy, on September 25th at the Bookmarks Festival in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. But for now, Wiley, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Charlie. That was fun.
Inside the Writer's Studio is sponsored by Bookmarks, a literary nonprofit that runs the largest annual book festival in the Carolinas and operates a community gathering place and nonprofit independent bookstore in downtown Winston-Salem, North Carolina. To find out more about Bookmarks and all its programs, visit www.bookmarksnc.org. Inside the Writer's Studio is proud to be affiliated with Libro FM. Unlike other audiobook platforms, Libro FM supports your local independent bookstore. Whether you buy a single book or, like me, a monthly subscription, you can link your account to your local store or to Bookmarks to support literary community. For a special 2-for-1 offer, go to Libro.fm and use the discount code WRITERS. If you've enjoyed Inside the Writer's Studio, please consider leaving a rating or review online at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Inside the Writer's Studio posts new episodes on the 1st and 15th of every month. In our next episode, I'll be talking with more novelists from this year's Bookmarks Festival of Books and Authors coming up on the 24th and 25th of September. Until then, thanks for listening, and may you read with wonder and write with passion.